welcome everyone. This is Talking VTE number 27 for the 8th of December 2010. My name's Stefan Ujway, and I'm here face to face with four others in Sydney and a couple of people online via Skype. So this is the lucky last Talking VTE for the year. So what we'll do is we'll go around the table initially with the online audience and Alison Miller. How are you?
Good, thank you, Stefan. Mm-hmm. Well fed, well oiled.
Indeed. We've been eating and drinking, so no better way to prepare ourselves for our end of year podcast. And Rose Grosdanek.
Hello, everybody.
And of course, Michael Coughlin, who would normally be joining us online, but is here face to face with us this evening.
And probably more oiled than normal because of that.
That's right.
And smoking my surrogate cigarette.
Well done.
Ah, yes. Well. And of course, that was Michael giving us the little wonderful guitar intro. So it won't be a. I don't know. Will that be a Creative Commons attribution we can ascribe to that?
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'd like £50 or something, $50 for every time that this podcast is played over the next year.
Oh dear.
£50 of what? Sugar?
No, CC would be fine.
One chicken, perhaps.
A meal.
Beautiful playing, thanks, Michael.
Who was that?
We worried
it was Howard.
Howard, hi.
I'm a fan.
You
sure?
And two, of course, our next face-to-face participant, Robin J.
Hi, everyone.
And perhaps we should just over to the online audience. We have Barbara Dew, who's having her breakfast.
Hello, good morning from Brazil.
Thank you, Barbara. Very decent of you to come in at very short notice. And we had to make assurances that there were no webcams.
But she's not well oiled, she's just well slept.
That's right. And Howard Erie. I was actually schooled on how to say it, Howard, but I've forgotten already. How terrible is that? So welcome.
Thank you, Stefan. Hi, everyone.
Hello, Howard.
Well, so here we all are, and I guess the themes for tonight weren't really well prescribed, but in a way it's a sort of roundup for the year, Talking VTE. We did have a topic of the e-portfolios, partly in response to Michael's podcast about them. But I think anyone who wants to bring in a topic about reflecting on the year in e-learning, in education, some of us would like to talk about WikiLeaks, some would not. That would be an interesting discussion, I think. It's very topical at the moment. Mm-hmm. And gives us an interesting litmus test about contemporary social media, journalism, politics, the state, and freedom of expression. So that would be a valuable thing to talk about. Anyone want to begin?
A wrap up.
Wrap up? Anyone want to go around? Perhaps we could go around and just people could talk about what was significant for them this year, 2010. We're just about, of course, to go into the New South Wales e-learning showcase, e-learning 2010 or e-learning 10. That's why many of us are gathered here this evening, and that would be an interesting reflection as well about the framework and about e-learning.
Why don't we leave it open-ended and just see what emerges from the soup?
From the soup.
Sorry. So, what was the killer app for 2010, that guy?
I don't know whether what the killer app is as important than the fact that the app has clearly won. I think at the start of this year there was discussion about whether or not the app had a life, because when we had browsers, and I used to hear comments like, why would you do that? Because the browser already does this. I mean, all the app is a kind of a couple of steps shorter than going into a browser. But now, and I think if there was a killer app, it was the iPad, and what the iPad has done has spawned a whole new generation of apps, and apps are clearly, I mean, they've won. It's app v the browser, it's apps.
For now, yeah, they have.
And but that's driven by the mobile device.
Yeah.
The lack of the keyboard on the iPad and the touch screen on both the mobile devices and the iPad.
Mm.
So the need to get somewhere quickly without having to URL it has changed.
Yeah.
And the fact that they all do something, and the fact that there are constraints, which I always think is a good thing in innovation.
And they do things that we never really realise. Like, I've got an app on my mobile phone that's a torch. So it's not really a torch, but it's a torch. I'm just going to show
you. Magnifier. Give us an audio version of that.
And what? And the torch has several colours.
It's a flashlight. Does it?
Oh my god!
So it looks like a torch on the screen.
It's a torch.
It uses the flash from the camera on the mobile phone, which means at night you can do it. But Michael, you're gonna trounce me. You've got coloured lights.
This is going to be really good to look at. I can choose any colour I want, so I can use this for photographs. But yeah, there's an incredibly useless app.
Let me just tell you, looking at apps on an iPhone makes for a really good radio, just so you...
Well, for those listening, of course, we had iPhone and an Android device here, so we represented on the two successful forays into the two platforms that have really transformed the mobile arena.
Look, a year ago, I had... a little HP laptop from work that had been killed by an operating environment from an institution and a monitor, and I had a dead Vaio, and I had my iPhone. And you know, for me the big thing this year has been my iPad. I'm the only one here with an iPad, but
Michael's
have
got
you
that.
Got one? You still got yours.
It's silent.
But
silent.
I tell you, you know, I would never go back. I was a little bit reserved about it, but it's been a really fantastic purchase for me. I've never regretted it.
One of the things I really like about it, and this kind of hooks in with your comment, Rose, about kind of having things a little circumscribed, or I came across this notion of curated computing soon after I bought the iPad, and they were arguing that one of the things that makes the iPad really successful is that its kind of native job is to just to do a few things.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can do anything on an iPad if you force it to, but it's just easy to use. You use it for X, Y, and Z, and for all those other more complex tasks, you go back to a more traditional computer. And I just think that's a really interesting idea, that you've got this device that's curated.
Mm. Well, when I mentioned constraints, I was talking more rules of entry, and I think that the other thing is anything that comes through the door has been tested, has been approved, so it's, I think, even though that might be invisible, nothing doesn't work.
Quality.
So you don't have any bad experiences, per se.
Mm.
What do the rest of you think about the killer app, just to follow on from the original question?
You were looking at me.
I'm looking at Howard.
And the online audience, because it's easy for us to dominate here face-to-face.
Hearing about you talk about the iPad... I'm very close to buying one, I think, and at the same time, I saw a cartoon about what's the difference between an iPhone and an Android, and the answer was, well, with the Android, if you want to do something, if you tweak it this way, you know, tweak it that way a bit, then you do some calculation and a little bit of programming, you can probably make it do it. But what if I want to do it on an iPhone? No, you can't do it. And it made me think that I like the possibility of the challenge that an Android might bring me. It might not bring me the speed and convenience, but it keeps me thinking and on the feet. So while, yes, I agree, Michael, it's the age of the app, I'm also a little bit uncomfortable with the massive ease and convenience, I guess. That a little bit of discomfort may not be a bad thing.
I see that there's a lot of consuming going on, so it's very much around a consumer market. So you can consume lots of stuff on it, but creating stuff in some of those spaces is quite restricted.
And that might work. We were listening to Genevieve Bell last week in terms of, I can't remember the synergy numbers, but in the US, the amount of information that's pushed out to consumers, the speed that it's pushed out to consumers as opposed to the speed that allows consumers to upload is like 90 to 10 or something. So
the same here.
It's very, no, not as great as in the US. So it's very much about a consumer market. And so that's what worries me when, you know, ideally the web is about having the voice. It's the WikiLeaks. You know, maybe it's not quite what we'd like it to be, but it means that people have found a voice, a space for their voice that they never had 5 or 10 years ago.
Yeah, look, I think, I mean, I was searching this morning for mind map applications, and there are about 8 fairly highly rated things that I found that were all quite unique, and they were all, you know, they were all, you know, small developers that had found a market for their stuff, and there were some really nice things there. You know, I would think that there is probably very little that you would want to do on an iPad or look for on an iPad where someone somewhere in the world with those development skills hadn't put some effort into. So, you know, I think that is, hopefully that process of developing applications will become easier, just as developing things for the open web became easier over time. But
I think the iPad is in that category. Until you've got it in your hands and sit there for a half an hour or so, you really don't know. And once you're doing it and you think, this is amazing. It just transforms the computing experience.
It's a beautiful object. It definitely is. I have been a bit away from all the technology part this year. I have disconnected a bit and have just been observing and reading and more involved in, let's say, observing young people working on open data and Transparency Day and hacking and all that. And I think that my interest has moved from, let's say, applications to what people are doing, really, and how they are engaging in this world and trying to make sense of it. So it has been an interesting experience. So I'm afraid I cannot talk much about APIs or I've just been looking around at people working.
And have they been using devices like iPads and iPhones and mobile devices?
I think that, well, there is the problem of cost, obviously, and access. People have been trying to, I don't think that we have many iPads here. There has been suggestion for people to use iPads and similar books for open educational resources so they could upload in one, let's say, place all the open material for schools. And but that's about it. I'm not aware of what is really being done. I know private schools have adopted this, but they have the means. But I'm more interested in what's going on now in, let's say, what will happen to 90% of the population, not only 3%.
Yeah, Bea, I'm very interested in what you're saying about that. So talk more about that in terms of the meaning-making that you mentioned. Can you elaborate on what you... on that?
Well, I think that... I've come across many groups now, so I have been trying to expose myself to different people, not only people from the same, let's say, groups. And I noticed that, obviously, something I should have known before, that they all have different agendas and different objectives. And it's very hard to bring these people together. They all seem to be working in different directions in a certain way. So I see a young generation working in a different way, and I think there is a lot of effort spent and a lot of reinventing the wheel.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the impression I have. Like, I see initiatives like the Open Educational Resources here and there, like in New Zealand. I have been following this. I don't see a great uptake. I mean, there are lots of talk. And I see young people doing things. I see young people, like, you know, opening sites and building things for rescue and for education, which is not followed by universities and academy and all that. So this is worrying. And private businesses even. I mean, there's a completely different mentality. I don't know how to express it, but that's what I have been noticing.
But often change will happen where the greatest pain point is or where the greatest need is. So perhaps what you're saying is that there's spaces that where people need to create for themselves, whereas...
Exactly.
You know, some
for their needs. I mean, this is why I think that there is so much now being offered. We are sort of flooded by all these applications and all that, and people just lose their interest in a certain way. I lost my interest this year. I mean, I said that's enough. So there is a point where you just, you know, say, I don't want to listen about it anymore. I want to do something. So just to give you an example of something that really, for me, it was the high point of the year. It was a coincidence, but I was at a meeting on sustainable cities, a conference in March this year, and then I was tweeting the conference. There were a lot of people who were invited from abroad, and suddenly I got a tweet from an ex-student of mine. I think he was my student about 20 years ago, and he says, "Is that you, teacher?" Come on, yes, I saw you tweeting about, I don't know, the different people who were there. Are you interested in this? So we finally found that we had common interests. And he was in Brazil visiting. He's now living in Geneva, and he has a startup and contributes to many different companies. And, well, as he was here, I said, why don't you come over and we talk? So it was very nice. He came for a barbecue on Sunday, then we started talking. And I was facing a problem with trash at that time in the countryside, because the surface was not running, so we had trash all over, and we couldn't track where the trash was. So people were asking, you know, has the truck been to your place, or what's happening, so on, and we're paying for it, so nothing is happening. So I commented on this, and said it would be nice if we had something like a new Shahidi, you know, here, so people could phone or track through their phones. They could track the areas where the trash is accumulating, so we know whether the truck has passed, and we have at least a document to show the responsible people that the work hasn't been done. And I said we would need something that uses the phone or SMSs, because people don't have computers here. We don't have a connection. Michael knows we have absolutely no connection in the countryside. And he hadn't heard about Ushahidi, and I said it would need to be an open source device or something that is not closed in. Well, he's an engineer, so a month later he wrote to me, I'm working on a prototype. I was so impressed by what, I mean, you said, your needs, that I'm doing this. And then a month ago he wrote to me and he said, you know, the thing is ready, the prototype is ready, I've done it. It's called, if you Google it, you'll see Ushahidi meets Arduino. So he built a platform. Ushahidi is this platform that was developed in Kenya and that was used during Haiti earthquake and also, you know. So this is, I can write it here in the chat box for Stephen too. So there's an article he wrote about it, giving the specifications of what he did.
And
he's now going to use it, he's going to test it with a school in a school that where his daughter lives for global climate changes. So this is something that gives you a lot of pleasure because, I mean, obviously I didn't make it. He worked on this. But to see an idea sparking, you know, something from a conversation and then somebody taking care of it and building it and using it. So this is what is really good about it. If we could put together people with ideas, people who make things happen, right, and then you test it instead of having this flood of things on us, like you mentioned, the commercialism of everything.
So what you described is a problem that had a solution, rather than
something like that.
Thing for problems.
Mm-hmm. That, let's say, developers, instead of being in developing in, let's say, in a void, well, it's not a void, or to meet commercial expectations, to see what the needs are, and maybe get together with people, the throw list that people are not talking, people do not know exactly, and the objectives are different.
Well, that's a really nice segue. I'd like to observe that all of the other colleagues in this podcast very actively promote the use of technology to colleagues and teachers and that sort of stuff. So given what Barbara has just said about you know, a problem with a solution, can I ask you all why you think everyone should be using technology for teaching?
Well, first of all, because I think our learners do, and I think increasingly we have to, as educational institutions, meet the needs of our learners. We have to meet the needs of our customers, and that's something they just take for granted. Mediating their connectivity, their learning, their sharing, their collaboration through technology, and I think we have to meet them there. We have to match that challenge. And
so students coming through your colleges are asking for it and expecting it. Is that true?
Well, I think this year we're actually going to do a quite significant survey of students about what their needs are, what they expect of us, and what they would like of us. So we hope to get a better understanding of that. But certainly, we're finding in our institution more often than not, students are bringing technology, and we're provisioning them with that. So, for instance, we're reducing the number of computer classrooms that we have at the moment because students are bringing their laptops. Mm-hmm. And so we provide them wireless connectivity, authenticated wireless activity, but they bring their own equipment. So that's what we're seeing the trend. So we don't have to provision as much with computer classrooms.
Yeah, Steph, but I think that our students are becoming increasingly equipped with hardware, but I think we still have a significant role in introducing to them ways of using that hardware to enable them as learners. And I think there are assumptions made about that are incorrect. But getting back to Rose's question, I think we are using technology because as educators we have an obligation to provide the most relevant and enriching and exciting learning environment that we can possibly provide to students. And in this day and age, if we don't include what the web and technology and mobile technologies, etc., can bring to that, then we're doing our students a disservice.
For me, it's nothing's really changed. When I first started teaching, I showed television, I've got movies, and I played stuff on audio cassettes. I just used the technology of the day. It's just what you do in teaching, it's life. Now the technology's changed, so you're just playing with different technology. The principle's exactly the same, so in a sense, nothing's changed.
But the technology's changed, again, because again, it was all about a push technology. So it was all about what you were pushing out to the learner, whereas now, for me, the technology is about choice, it's about communication, and it's about connecting with other people. So we're speaking to somebody, you know, there's five of us here and the other one's in Sydney. Howard's about, what, 3 or 4 k's away, and then the other person's, you know, halfway around the world. And so that's that connection with people, and you can do that synchronously, like we are, or through the mobile device, asynchronously, through all of those Twitters and Foursquares and Facebook and so forth. So that's where I think it changes, is that your communication with individuals hyped up majorly, hence why...
Yeah, the communication and also the possibility to create together,
yes.
Like in the example I gave,
and now...
with what I'm doing now, yeah. Exactly. So I'm participating in this podcast. I mean, you know, so this is something that's, and meeting you all in a certain way, something that would have never happened before.
No, well, you're comfortably having breakfast and someone knocks on your door and says, you want to come and have a
cup of wine? What about you, Howard? Why is technology, I mean, obviously, like many of us at this table and B, is it takes a lot of our lives. It's what we focus a lot of our lives in trying to help people engage in technology.
Yes, it does. I think in one way, what's underlying and a step before the technology is that we raise young people to be whole people, and as educators do whatever we can to engage them, and then to include where possible the context that we're in, which is that we have at the moment these extraordinary developments that we can take advantage of. I'm thinking at the moment of my daughter, who's 15 years old, and she this week has gone away on a horse riding camp up to the high country. And I'm really happy about this, and I know she's probably going to have a wonderful experience. The point of it is that while she's out there in the bush having to deal with horses and solve different problems, I feel that is in some ways resourcing her really well, that will then lead to possibly some of the ways that she will approach the world, and that includes technology. And so I think we use the advantages that we've got in technology as the context, but I don't know that we necessarily, and I think you probably all agree with me, we don't, technology is not the reason for doing things that we do with young people. It's but where we can take advantage of it, it can create wonderful opportunities.
So earlier tonight, before the podcast started and we were having dinner, we were talking about the ubiquity of Moodle and how Moodle has been the choice of educators to do that very thing. And it just strikes me that that's sort of an interesting juxtaposition here as well, in terms of Moodle being the answer to a question that sort of isn't there.
Yes, I'd agree.
In a way. No, well, I'd just be interested. It was an interesting conversation, so I'd sort of invite my colleagues here in person to continue that discussion in light of what you're all saying about appropriateness and fit for purpose and that sort of stuff. It's sort of interesting that what you're saying is not actually reflected in our work so often. Do you know what I mean?
I think...
Yes.
Sorry, go on.
Go on. No, I'd like to hear your comments first.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, last week I spent some time with Lee Blackall, who was sort of saying, you know, chuck, you know, all of the LMS is out. And but, you know, as educators, we still spend a hell of a lot of time talking about content and producing content. And that's why I think Moodle appeals to a lot of educators, because it's a space where they can dump this content and maybe make it look good or not make it look good. But hey, you know, I've produced this online space. I might have moved this paper handout into a Word doc or a PDF, but hey, this is my space and I've dumped that content there. So, I mean, Moodle's... my theory is if people are in Moodle, they're at least on the train. They probably aren't using it to its full capacity. in terms of creating connective communicative spaces for people, but at least they're in a community where they can start having those conversations.
Mm-hmm. Why not dump your content in Wikipedia, Wikiversity, exactly. WikiEducator instead of in a Moodle?
Well, if you like us and you work for the government, you're legally not allowed to dump content here, there, and everywhere.
I think it's because Moodle carries with it a grade centre. Moodle carries with it, in addition to being a repository, dump the PDF.
Oh, the compliance.
It is also a grade centre.
Yep.
And you can link in, turn it in, and all the nasty plagiarism tools and everything else you want.
Compliance.
So it's about compliance. So, you know, I mean, something.
So nothing has changed finally.
No, Bea, I don't
just reproducing.
Yeah. I don't think
the same model.
And I think when it comes down to it, people's philosophy towards education hasn't changed much. It's still very much an expert-centred, content-driven, admin-focused space.
Mm.
And in 90% of Moodles, I would suggest, are largely a place for putting your PDFs and grading students. In that sense, I agree with Lee. Moodle for me is just another LMS. The fact that it happens to be, open source and connects a little better to community and to third-party tools that, web 2 oriented, etc., is irrelevant for most users, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, the only exception maybe is the Scope community in Canada, that Sylvia Curry carries all these discussion forums and all that. I think she has been using Moodle quite successfully.
But in terms of openness, and that was something... a discussion Lee was talking about last week, where I think someone at the university he's at the moment, they were doing motivation and something in terms of behavioural studies, and what they didn't have a textbook, so what they did is they assigned a chapter to each of the groups of students, who then created the content and then created this sort of wiki educator type book.
Mm-hmm.
And initially some of the students didn't put their names on the chapter. They put a pseudonym there until the resource got some hit off, and then they were just keen to try and see if they could change it to their real name. Because their openness is good, but you don't always want absolutely everything about everything you do open to everybody.
Oh, no.
So sometimes that's what the other thing, something that a learning management system does, is create a small, safe haven for people to come together and extend and sort of trial things. So I call it a safe sharing space.
Later on, I mean, what you do there can be put up, and I think it should be reported openly so that other people can take advantage of it and build on top of it or get ideas. So I'm very much for openness in this sense. I have learned a lot from openness, so I try to do my thing as well, my share.
I mean, Moodle essentially is an instructivist model platform. It is driven by the teacher or educator.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's very little in there that students can initiate.
Exactly.
Is that right? Students can't.
No, they can't. A student,
unless it's switched on for
them. Yeah.
In the same way, applications are closed and we have no choice whatsoever what we can do with them. And this comes to the article I posted and then Michael commented on.
So, same thing. I haven't used Moodle and I don't use Facebook. So compare it with Facebook, which is a closed system and is a content management system. So why are there 500 million people who can't be torn away from that I'm just interested in why one is so popular and the other...
Facebook.
Because it offers... Exactly. It offers all sorts of things that education doesn't.
Yeah.
It's a meeting place. It's a club.
Okay, so why couldn't they do
that? But the irony is that Facebook began in an educational context.
Oh, I mean, by a student.
Yeah, by a student.
Created by a student.
And Zuckerberg knew... I mean, Zuckerberg created it because... At Harvard, it gave the allure of exclusivity, so it was a club. The idea of a club was important to its inception, but it was about connecting students in an educational context.
So I don't know if it was about it was actually taking their yearbook and putting it online. So if you sort of fancied that chick in your 300-person class, you could at least find out who they are and how you connected with it was one of the things he did. And the other thing he did was also about creating a space because he had to do, something about well-respected pieces of art, and he hadn't done the study. So what he did is set up a space where people could fill all the information in as a group study class, and basically they gave him all the content that he studied for that week and then passed it down. So it was never sort of from an educational driven space.
No, in theory, why couldn't Moodle evolve?
It was neat, yeah.
Yeah, like neat. Everything, like your trash example, it's all neat. Mm-hmm. So why couldn't Moodle evolve?
Well, you know, Martin Dougiakis would like it to involve. He's created these hubs or communities in Moodle 2.0 for educators to share, and that makes me worry that he's probably not dealt with too many educators because that concept of educating and share doesn't often go down too well.
I think what
Robin was saying before, it's not the tool. The tool could potentially be quite creative, but the system of education hasn't changed.
Yes,
the
totally.
Thinking behind education hasn't changed. So what
I
we
agree.
Do is we just pick up the piece of paper, we put it into a PDF, and we say, I'm online, tick the KPI, you know, the e-learning strategy, tick, and everybody just is happy.
No, we've got the KPI, we're not of sustainability. So the driver for Moodles is photocopying.
Excuse me, the driver behind TAFE-SA's Moodle was that printing budget got cut.
Yes. Yes.
That was nothing about pedagogical practice or about creating needs or choice for students.
But you're transferring the printing cost to the student, of course.
Someone the other day actually told me that they'd reached their target for e-learning, so they were just going to cruise for the next 3 years.
Yeah.
You know, the thing that is similar, I mean, Moodle and Facebook are the same in that they are both gated communities.
Mm-hmm.
Both of them are gated communities. One is driven by the users, and one is driven by the institution. That is really the only difference. I mean, the technologies that are sitting away from those, which are the wikis and open blogs and other platforms like that, are the ones that are really sitting separate to that. And what I've seen this year is those things being increasingly rejected.
But I would argue that Facebook's not driven by the community. I think the community, a good parent or a good teacher, says, we'll give you this space
it's driven by the people who put applications in there, and by marketing. It's not by users. I mean, users just consume.
However, it does seem to be serving a need, and people are using it without having a gun to their head, so I find that really interesting. And so maybe some people don't need to be part of the whole community, like we're part of our little community at the moment in this room rather than having invited everyone off the street in. So I don't know that there's anything.
That's right, Rose. I think
people off the street.
I think.
But Robin, I'll be just trying to get
you off the street. Really, it's about being informed and being literate and being very savvy about how you use it. Mm. And if you're all those things, then you can use it to your own purposes rather than being used.
Mm.
And it certainly has the potential for abuse. But as we were talking about earlier tonight, a lot of our technologies have that potential. Mm.
But what percentage of people who are using Facebook have the critical literacies you're talking about?
Very few.
The same have the same talk.
Yeah, because sitting here and drinking wine and saying, oh, this expensive wine. Like, I mean, what? No, but it's the same as television. It's the same as mass media. It's the same.
People, and I'm not saying that, you know, obviously for a lot of people it's doing quite well. I mean, what we're doing is talking about the negatives of it. There's lots of positives of it.
Mm-hmm.
It connects us with our community halfway, our family halfway around the world. So I can keep in touch with what's happening with my family in Scotland, you know, as it's happening. So, I mean, there's some really positive stuff of it, but, you know, the majority of them aren't using it with very good critical literacies. You know, they're just...
And perhaps you're right, perhaps that's where the difference is, because the reason we're actually involved with students in the first place is we do have that relationship with them. We're not their friends, we actually are. We do have a function in terms of enriching them.
You would hope.
All credit. Howard, are you still with us? I'd be very interested in some comment from you and Michael.
Do you have a Facebook account?
Yes, I do. I'm wary of it.
He's got two teenage daughters. He's in there. Sorry.
Yeah, that's right. And it's been wonderful for some connecting with them. I was thinking about what's really driving it, and it's still something, I guess, that's evolving at an alarming way. That it takes up half the internet, reduces, I think, the creativity and openness of the internet. I also am reminded of a comment that Kerry Packer made once, which is the purpose of television is to bring audience to advertisers. And, you know, I worry that Facebook, as it brings in the large capitalisation, that it starts to take on that kind of perspective as well.
One thing that concerns me about, one thing I've found interesting is that with apps, people engaging with apps and people engaging either, you know, in this mediated environment, all their surfing is mediated through Twitter recommendations, or their experiences online are mediated through Facebook relationships. It doesn't seem to me that there are a lot of people actually just surfing the web and serendipitously finding things or looking for things. So it seems to me that there is a narrowing.
What happened to stumble upon?
But the trouble is, Rose, that the web is so huge. You've got to filter. People need to filter it in some way.
Yes.
Whether you are filtering it via your Twitter connections or via Facebook or via Buzz or, you know, your Google Reader or whatever it is. I mean, I think most of us throw terms into Google search engines every now and again and find new things that we contribute to the community, but it's just
it's just like life. I mean, the internet is just like life. I mean, you also have to filter your world around. The virtual is just like, I mean,
but
normal
when you,
world.
But when you have a choice about that, you don't tend to end up in as heterogeneous environments as you would. Philip Adams once talked about, like, the world reducing down to a community of one, you know, like this echo chamber. And I actually do think, I mean, it's a completely different subject, but I don't know.
But I think for you're the right in that we live in a very mediated world. So we live under laws, we live under, you know, restrictions, there's, ethics. And I certainly believe our education system is a very, very mediated world. The school system's a very mediated world. It's not about your creative intelligence, it's about how well you can regurgitate information. And so there's not an expectation that people will create. The expectation is that people will do as they're told and conform to the crowd. Because if you don't in the school sector, if you don't conform to the crowd, you're very, very quickly picked up and shown to everybody you are different in a bad way.
Hasn't it ever been thus? Beg your pardon? Hasn't it ever been thus? Like, I think that students today, because they do have the technology at home, are far more, have far more access to
the outside world and other ideas than we did in our schooling.
But it was interesting because at Converge there was a lady, Tanya somebody.
Tanya Major.
She's an Australian Indigenous, a young Australian Indigenous of the Person of the Year, and I think it was her. But something in lots of cultures, freedom of information isn't necessarily a given right. So you have, you know, secret women's business, you have to become a certain age before you get to do certain things. So is there an expectation, because information is ubiquitous now with the net, that we think everybody can have everything?
Well, I think it's very cultural. I think there are accepted modes of communication, and if you step outside those, then you do so at your own risk.
Well, that may be a useful juncture to raise Julian Assange.
I mean, conspiracy.
As he stepped outside the... outside the boundary.
No, I say good on him. My mum gave me a diary when I was 12 with one of those little locks, and I thought that was going to hold all my secrets for the world. And she said to me, don't write it down if you don't want anybody to read it. So if you didn't want anybody to read it, don't write it down. If you're not doing the right thing, it will eventually bite you on the bum.
Yeah, look, I think it's a flood, and I think, you know, whether they lock him up or assassinate him, as some lunatics in America would suggest, you know, it's like putting your finger in a dike. It's a turning point in terms of media and freedom of information and transparency in government affairs. And there's no going back from this point forward. Whether you like him or not, this is a significant point in time.
Is that you, Howard?
It sounds like a lion.
Yeah, sorry, it's in the background here.
Oh, okay.
Can you pat it for me?
Howard, I've heard you speak twice about, and you want to do it at e-learning 10, so if you get to go to Howard's presentation the next 2 days, highly recommends it.
How much fire can I steal?
But Howard, can you link some of the stuff you're talking about in your Promethean
story? How much fire can I take?
With this WikiLeaks stuff.
I'm just writing, it's interesting you ask, because I'm writing a blog post about that at the moment. And I'll probably stick it up in the next day or so I'll let you know about it. I think he's a bit Promethean, but I don't know that he hasn't stolen fire necessarily, but I think he's a part of the breaking up of the extraordinary power structures that we've had over the last 80 years.
In the Western world, yeah.
And I can see that it's perhaps some other archetypes that are playing out in this, which is what I'm suggesting in the blog post. So it's partly Promethean in that he is stealing something from the gods in a way, but I think it's not so much. Well, it is a little bit Promethean, isn't it? I mean, he is for many people a hero, which is really.
I'm thinking more Mercury, because Mercury is the god of communication as well as the trickster. You know, Hermes, Mercury sort of thing. So it's interesting that they go together in.
That could be the case. I'm also interested in Mark Pesce's comments in one of his posts on the ABC, which have been, the two of them are really fantastic, I think. But in particular, he talked about the Napster phenomenon being the blueprint for what then happened in the music industry. And I think, again, Julian and WikiLeaks is just a symptom of something that's bigger that's going on. And you know, after WikiLeaks, there'll be something else. We won't go backwards on this, I don't think.
But history's got... I've said before we started tonight that I wasn't going to say anything about this, so I'm actually going to back out now.
Go, Rose.
No.
Quick, where's my pause button?
I was just wondering, when we were talking about openness earlier, that whether or not what Julian Assange has done is going to make people who were opposed to the idea of being open with content and education, he's going to make that harder, because there are a whole lot of people who that's what openness does. Look what he did. He gave away all these secrets, put people in danger, kind of ruined relationships between people and countries. Yeah, so he may have made it really tricky for us when we're advocating open approaches in education. My personal view is I'm leaning towards, I think he's a hero, but his life is in grave danger, methinks. But nice, you think of it as a blueprint, Howard, and that, yeah, there's no going back.
Look, Michael, I think the people who are frightened of openness of openness in all ways, they are the people who use LMSs. They are the people who don't post anything on the open web. They live in a closed space.
And this is
their
most
life
people.
Is closed.
Yeah, but we're the odd ones.
Absolutely. I agree.
We cannot force them to go open.
But the thing is, Michael and I had a discussion last week about the religious backgrounds that are in my family, and I thought it was quite bizarre. And I was saying how that within my family's religious belief, it was about perpetuating a lot of anger. You know, not even it's about perpetuating good, it was about perpetuating a lot of anger. And Michael's comment was that when he remembers growing up, that they weren't encouraged to marry outside of their religious group. So there could be some genetic stuff, and again the cultural stuff, that there's not an automatic right to all information that's everywhere. I mean, we've all been very lucky in that we've all been well educated, we're quite liberal, we're quite affluent, so we get to experience all of this. But does that mean that the other, you know, 99.9% of the world will live that way?
I'd like to go back a little bit to what Michael said about this business harming, let's say, openness. But I think it follows a pattern. I mean, you see something happening, like disclosing a secret, opening up. So it is. Then you have the person, Julian Assange, who is accused of sexual prowess, whatever, and rape and so on. So his reputation is brought down. Then he is, let's say, taken under custody, refused bail and all that. So this is, as you say, a message. It's fear. It's spreading fear. So it is the enforcement of government and all that. See what happens to you when you do things like this. So the punishing and exposing a person's life in all details, right? So I don't think it is. I don't know how to take it. I think it's good to denounce this kind of pattern that happens. It's like seeding fear in I don't know.
I agree, B, that it's about fear, but I think the reaction of governments is because they are very, very fearful. They are very scared of the potential of this. So I think there are two levels to this fear. I think what is being said by governments and the reaction of governments is because they are afraid.
Yet at the same time, they're saying things like this person should be assassinated. Like, I'm absolutely so shocked at how openly people are saying and doing really stupid things that you would not recommend. Like, I would not recommend, if I was trying to be a government that pretended to be a certain thing, I would not recommend that my senators or whatever say that people should be assassinated. I find it astonishing that credit card systems, all the systems that manage payments like Visa and MasterCard, postal services, I'm amazed at all these commercial operations without any explanation are suddenly entering this dynamic and making decisions. And so the real story for me is about the way people are playing, that they're revealing so much more about themselves than the leaks ever could, and the way they're behaving is very, very, very odd. So I find it very odd, for instance, that MasterCard, which as far as I know is, you know, just a credit card place, would make a decision to do that without there being any crime per se that's been committed, nor any government that has told them to do that. So I find that very weird.
Look, I mean, the thing about WikiLeaks, I mean, in a lot of countries, Julian Assange would have just been murdered. In Russia, journalists who speak out against state
China.
Violence, state corruption, are just summarily executed. Likewise, in a lot of other countries. So I think it's interesting that, you know, he's able to play out this public engagement, at the moment.
In a way, the safest place he can be is in jail.
Maybe.
Quite possibly, yeah.
Maybe, yes. What happened to the guy, the Melbourne criminal underground guy? But, I mean, there's a couple of things. The one is, will WikiLeaks go on just because he's not there? Surely he's not a one-man band.
Splintered into hundreds of mirrors.
Sorry, I mean, he's not a one-man band. So if people are strong enough about it. The other point is around the invention of the Gutenberg press, where previously, you know, the church's religion held written text. That's how information, if you wanted to remember information or you know about information, you had to recite it, you had to remember it, it was all held in your own head. And there was lots of things said about when the Gutenberg press came, and it was all put on paper and how the masses were going to have, and it was all poo-hooed by the church. And I suppose it's just a change of behaviour, like we know ourselves. When you're trying to change behaviour, you're going to get rebellion.
Yeah. Is it the disintermediation of journalism?
Disintermediation? No, because that's already happened through blogs and that sort of stuff. That's the other thing.
Because in the past it was often, you know.
No, I think the disintermediation has already happened.
Watergate was put out by a newspaper. They had their source and they didn't reveal their source. So, you know, major journalists revealed information that was secret, that was the state corruption, state...
That term usually refers to is they were the gatekeepers of that information.
Yeah.
But I think that has already happened through, a million blogs shall bloom.
Yeah,
and so,
I agree.
And that's why journalism has been declining. The other thing that I have found really interesting about this is I think it's holding out a fresh leaf to journalists, because this is the first time I've seen really good quality journalism in a long time, where a lot of people are actually talking. We were talking about this before. There's discourse around this. Because it is grey, there's no one who's... I mean, there are a few lunatics who are saying, oh, this is fantastic or this is bad, but most people are somewhere in the middle actually analysing what this means. And I find that actually very interesting for journalism. So disintermediation has happened, in my view, but it might be holding out a leaf for people who do want to be journalists to see how that might be done in this new environment. That's my view anyway.
So is it improving critical literacy?
Which performance indicator is that?
It's revealing how the world has been run for a long, long time.
Yeah,
and the truth is just coming out. And what Howard's point
and
is
Howard's
breaking
changed.
Down the power structures.
So Howard, what's your prediction? Oh, sorry, Michael.
It hasn't changed. It may change now, because everybody in politics and government actually have to accept the fact that whatever they say is going to be public, and these behind-the-scenes communications are no longer toxic.
Sorry to interrupt, but I think that, I mean, when you release 250,000 documents, who is going to read all that? We're flooded by information on the other side, so this is not going to be important anymore in a certain way.
It
changes. It's Pakistan's turn one week, it's Israel's turn the next week, the following week it'll be Chile.
It's not about those individual documents, it's about the whole philosophy, it's about the whole...
Yeah.
Paradigm.
I think that,
and whatever happened to Julian Assange, whether he lives or doesn't, or WikiLeaks lives or doesn't, in a way is irrelevant, because that change has been made. It's like saying, we can kill Osama bin Laden and kill terrorism. It's just a ridiculous
But I think that the 250,000 gives it authority. They're saying that there's a lot of information that's held within government that's not transparent, it's not open to people. The other part of it is, yeah, 250,000 is a lot, but when you get the data analysis tools in, you can distill that very quickly as to looking for particular types of stuff. I think the question should be, who the hell is releasing out of the government
disgruntled employees?
And why?
Because they're disgruntled. They want the truth out.
Right. Yeah, no, I agree. That's the question. That is a very significant question.
I think it
cuts to the whole legitimacy of democracy in Western societies, where governments are just being operating illegitimately.
Except I remember reading something about whistleblowers, and I can't remember who it was, but I do remember them saying that whistleblowers quite often are not doing it for the common good, they're doing it for revenge, or there's all these other motivations, because...
That's why Zuckerberg made Facebook, according to the media.
Yes. But I also think we're being a bit optimistic, or we're looking at the optimistic spectrum, because most of the communications we do have with each other nowadays are mediated through, you know, telephone, email. It's very unusual to have a face-to-face conversation. So all of that is recorded, recordable, controllable. So I think you do need to also consider the dystopian side of the equation, where it is possible for every single act of communication to be managed, controlled, surveilled, and all that sort of stuff as well.
So what does is there stuff that needs to be kept private, and what is it, and how does that fit into this new model?
I don't know whether we... I just want to say now, this Shirky, the cognitive surplus.
Yeah.
So what was it?
Clay Shirky's the cognitive surplus.
The cognitive surplus?
Yeah, rather than the dystopia, he has a completely different point of view. And it doesn't answer your question about what should be kept private. But Shirky's basically arguing that people, if given the opportunity, and opportunity is crucial, a potential reward... They will do, as you said, Rose, they will go into Facebook without anyone holding a gun to their head. They will just do good things.
I think people are like that deep down. Everyone I speak to says no. It's self-interest rules, and you know, they're all aimed.
I often thought that too, but Shirky's kind of bringing me around.
But isn't Shirky say only if you stop watching television?
managing
your time,
when you take
wasting your time on banality, and actually start doing something useful.
Well, that's another side of his argument. But he's saying that the world is still watching TV, and we've got Wikipedia. The world is still watching TV, and we've got you, Shahid. What happened if we actually stopped watching television just 10%? What could we do?
Oh my God!
Right, and he has great faith that we will.
Because we multitask. We still work with the TV's on and the iPod and the iPad and the Mac. It's all on.
His message is there's no such thing as, oh, I'm far too busy to do that. It's about priorities.
Yes, of course it is. It's like anything.
He's right.
It's having the confidence to reprioritise and go ahead. Because that makes a big difference about how you feel and how you feel your support system will go with you. And also, it's quite interesting, Howard, the second time I've heard Howard Prometheum talk, it's so right that, you know, often people that stick their necks out in terms of innovation or different things or WikiLeaks, there's a really good, a much higher chance, statistically, that your head will get chopped off. And so where is the incentive to be... Unless you're going to make a million out of it, because then people go, oh, well, of course, it's because you're going to make money. If you're not going to make a million out of it, which this Julian guy obviously isn't going to make a million out of it, he's just going to make some history
out of it. Or get waterboarded.
So, you know, is that what keeps innovation in you know, under control? You know, we don't allow... I mean, the human ideas are infinite. Right, there's no sort of restriction on new ideas and new ways of doing things, but it doesn't mean that we see lots of innovation in terms of action.
I'm not sure exactly what your question is, but you know, we're in an extraordinary age, as we all know, and I every day have to pinch myself feeling so lucky that we have the opportunities that we have.
Yeah.
Because of the extraordinary innovations that we have. You know, we live like kings and queens. I'm not sure where it will go. I suspect that we'll have periods where it will, that there'll be cycles between openness and innovation and periods where things tend to become more structured and restricted. Mm. Because I think both parts of part of our human nature, that the kind of hyper capitalism and hyper rationality that we've been experiencing, and abuses of power that we're starting to see, that we kind of everyone knew about. That's the funny thing about it. We all knew this was going on, but it took WikiLeaks to actually just tell us what we all knew, but. But you change everything.
Shame,
yeah, that's right.
Shame. Oh, look, we knew it anyway. After the Iraq War and that whole search for weapons of mass destruction, no one surely had any doubt about what was going on.
No, but if you've got a good story, I mean, that's how things have happened. That's how Christianity's evolved. You know, if you've got a good story, it doesn't matter whether it's true or not, how well you tell the story.
Yeah, the thing about WikiLeaks is I actually don't think there's anything been really, really, really quite profound come out of it, except that it's, you know,
It's a principle.
Yeah, just a principle. That shocking violence that the Americans did against the journalists in Iraq, with their helicopter, you know, where they just opened fire on all those innocent people from a helicopter. Beyond that, it's all been communication between, you know, cables between diplomats.
I've actually been surprised at how unremarkable some of it has been in terms of, you know, describing that Italian prime. So I've actually been heartened to think that the people around the world who work for governments are just public servants like us who are just giving advice in the same way. So if anything, I have got a higher view than I did 2 weeks ago. So, and I don't think governments are taking that into account. They're freaking out instead of sitting back a bit and just watching to see what happens, because I don't think anything's going to happen particularly.
But in a good Web 2.0 model, surely they should be listening to their customers and seeing how they could move forward together.
Oh, we're not customers.
Well, no, but you know what I mean, in terms of listening to the voices of the people, whether you make them...
Some are starting to do that.
Right.
Alison, some are doing that, and it is changing in a gradual way. I think this will speed it up.
I really liked Rab's answer today when he went, well, of course people, you know, so, and like, I really, really like the way he's been handling... Well... You know, I actually think he's, of all of our politicians, he's probably been the most sensible, whether he's sincere or not. It was either sensible or sincerely a very good thing to do, the way he's responded.
I agree. I think he makes a very good prime minister, foreign minister, not a prime minister. I liked him as a foreign minister. He was a shocker as a prime minister. I now like him again now that he's back being a foreign minister.
And if all of them had reacted like that to the information, if I had been listening to the radio and all the politicians had responded in that way, I probably would not have paid much attention to WikiLeaks. I probably would have thought, my ear would have pricked up my ears, and then thought, oh yeah, just that, and I wouldn't have panicked.
Mm. Yep.
So that says a lot. Maybe I'm assuming that PR and spin doctors will also pick that up and maybe look at how they can maybe be more transparent. That would be an option they've got, to actually be a little bit more transparent and realise that people aren't going to freak out.
I mean, I look back and I look at, you know, the Gulf War. I look at Afghanistan. You look at, you know, the refugee situation in Australia. I mean, there's nothing really profound that's come out of WikiLeaks.
Oh,
that just makes you
good
think...
media.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's almost... In a way, it's almost like that thing about the blogs where there's all this sort of, you know, that thing...
Hype. A lot of hype.
Hype.
A lot of hype.
Can you imagine
maybe to hide something else, because nothing is going to be done about it. I mean, there's a lot of talk going on, and we assume and presume and talk about what is going to happen instead of doing the real thing that needs to be done.
And the cricket's been boring, and Australia didn't get the 2012 soccer. So, you know,
what else have we got?
But
to talk
it's
about?
Funny that John Pilger got up today, because that poor man's been writing books in great detail for the last 20 years that nobody reads except a few politics students from.
Oh, so viral.
So, you know, people sort of aren't interested in this stuff. It's interesting to me that, you know, sort of maybe people are ready to be interested. Because as you keep saying, Stefan, it's always been there, so it's not like there's any surprises.
Or is Nicaragua, El Salvador. Hello! Not news, it's a state, it's illegitimate, and a terrorist!
I think one of you said earlier, maybe what we needed was that we needed the story.
Yeah, telling the right kind of story. Well, but then that makes me wonder when you talk about this, if there's people that have already been doing this and it makes no media, why now is it important to the media? Because the media doesn't need to pick these stories up.
Interestingly, I think the media has acted out of character in this instance, in that they are actually following the story, whereas for the last decade that I can remember, they're not making stories.
Because they've been embedded. In Iraq and Afghanistan, they're embedded.
But also on a more mundane...
Or they went to these manufactured news conferences by the State Department and just went, oh, we'll go and put something in the paper that you just said. Yeah. There's nothing, you know.
Yeah.
Maybe this is the last breath of...
I actually think that
media are trying to grab onto.
Yeah, I think it's the best thing that's happened to journalism. And as someone who's very interested in journalism at the moment, I'm glued to this stuff, because I do think it holds out a hope for paid media to actually find another way of surviving and becoming the fourth estate once again.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if it will ever will, but I think it's trying to grab onto its, its dying death.
Barbara, just out of interest, what's your media doing over there in Brazil with all this?
Well, some you have different newspapers covering the thing from different perspectives. So for the closed public, it is a scandal for people, and then you have all the alternative media that is the blogs and that are our newspapers. Mainstream media is mostly let's say following or copying what's being said abroad. So. What is interesting to read is all the blogs and all the comments that go not in mainstream.
Just like
because this is where you get what the people think about it.
Yeah. Well, look, have we forgotten Abu Ghraib? How different is this from Abu Ghraib?
It is, isn't it?
I mean, that was a seminal moment. It certainly was for me.
Why? Because the information got out, or you discovered something that you didn't know ever happened?
Because the information got out. Because actually personnel who were there with their cameras, with their mobile phones, took pictures of this stuff and put it on the internet.
But they were showcasing.
Well,
They were
brazen, yeah.
New media. You know, military personnel there, you're right, perhaps, you know, not for all the
that
right reasons, but it's new media, direct to the internet,
but
can't
that was
stop it,
really
government can't control
that
it.
That was utterly explosive, and it was more the stupidity and ignorance of those people in posting it, and it was mediated by...
They're critical literacy, that's what I meant.
But it was, exactly, and it was mediated by journalists, so that's actually very different. And I think it was so dramatic, those pictures I will never forget. So maybe this is more of a slow burn, isn't it? And there's nothing that's come up. I mean, I'm sure there will be when people...
Well, it's some of it about giving other people the confidence to have a voice, to speak up when they know things aren't right.
Mm. Yeah, I don't know.
So, yeah. I mean, I suppose it's like any sort of innovation, that you're not going to see the change straight away. You know, there's a time lag to see where the change actually has impact. So perhaps we should book a time in for this time next year, Stephen.
Indeed. And well, on that note, we're at 1 hour 14, so we should wrap it up. So thanks to everyone, particularly those who we Skyped in at the last minute at their breakfast table, and Howard, no doubt, loved your evening.
Howard was the last.
Yeah, thanks for doing it.
It was lovely to get together again.
It was.
It was, B.
All right, thanks everyone.
See you tomorrow, Howard.
Thank you.
Yeah, see you tomorrow.
See you.
Looking forward to it.
See you. Bye-bye.
Online as quickly
nice
as
to meet you, B.
Takes.
Thank you for the invite. See you.
Bye.
As quick as WikiLeaks.
That was good.
I reckon they are going to kill him.
Oh, God.